Welcome to the 2023 Sight into Sound Christmas Special, The Colors of Christmas. In this year's special, we'll read about the origins of the colors that come to symbolize Christmas. The colors of red, green, gold, and the purity of white. For as long as we can remember, these colors have been associated with Christmas. But few people realize why these complementary hues represent the holiday or where its origins began. Let's hear the historical and spiritual meaning of these colors for this wonderful time of the year. I'm Terry Dorado.
Children laughing, people passing, meeting smile after smile. And on every street corner you hear
Silver Bells. In the song Silver Bells, written for the Bob Hope movie The Lemon Drop Kid in 1951, the streetlights are decked out for the holidays because they blink a bright red and green. Today, with the addition of yellow for caution, these same traffic signals now flash bright red, gold, and green. By doing so, they fully represent the pigments that have come to be the most visible in what is undoubtedly the most colorful time of the year. Why are green, red, and gold generally thought of as the colors of Christmas? While there are many stories and legends surrounding the use of these trio of hues, in truth, no one knows why or when these colors were chosen. No one has stepped forward to claim credit for deciding that these three colors would be assigned for holiday use. But when judged on their historic symbolism, green, red, and gold simply best define Christmas, it would be all but impossible to think of the holidays without them. In the more than 2,000 years since the birth of Christ, many colors, such as white, purple, and blue, have found their way into the spectrum of the season. But the trio of signal-like colors reigns. These three colors were not just haphazardly splashed on the canvas of the season, but were born out of existing holiday customs, combined with a knowledge of the story of Jesus' life. The first hue to be linked with Christmas was probably green. Long before Christ was born, green had been a powerful symbol of mystery and life. Ancient cultures observed the fir trees and holly bushes growing in the midst of the harshest winters and were fascinated. When all other plants had died or grown barren, the people of the woods believed that some type of magical power had to be fueling these evergreens' survival. Because of this flourishing life, when there seemed to be only death, these green survivors were both worshipped and feared. Some folks felt that evil had given the evergreen plants the power to evade the natural order of the seasons. Others taught that the gods had breathed life into them to preserve a bit of beauty during the bleak days of winter. While early humankind did not comprehend what made these plants live year-round, most cultures, especially in Europe, came to think of green as the color of life. During the feasts of the winter solstice, evergreen holly was woven into wreaths in Rome. As the Romans celebrated the passing of the shortest day of the year and looked forward to the rebirth of the sun and the return of warm weather, holly could be seen everywhere. It hung from doors and on the walls of homes and was even sold in shops. In the 4th century, when the church decided to celebrate Christ's birth on December 25th, which happened to be the final day of the annual celebration of the sun god Saturn, many Christians who had used holly to decorate for the Roman festival left the green sprays in place for Christmas as well. Thus, over time, holly and its green color came to be linked with Christ's birth. A few legends even place this bush or tree near Jesus as he lay in the manger. As green represented the life associated with the birth of Christ, red would come to represent his death on the cross. With such dark symbolism, this might seem a strange color to add to the Christmas bouquet. Yet, as important as the first chapter of the story of Jesus' life was, it was how his life on earth ended that made the events in Bethlehem really important. While holly leaves are always green, ancient civilizations were probably most fascinated by the red berries that sprang forth from the holly plants in the darkest days of winter. How could this plant, not only live, but also produce fruit when no other plants could. In the minds of most folks living in ancient times, the only answer was magic. As the holly became associated with Christmas, church leaders began to look for a way to erase the pagan myths that surrounded the plant and replace them with analogies that reflected the beauty, power, and truth of the Christian faith. Thus, the red berries that appeared when everything in the world seemed dead represented the blood of Christ and the eternal life that could belong to anyone who chose to accept the Lord as Savior. While green represented new life, red came to symbolize the reason for Christ coming to earth, dying, and then rising from the dead. Another plant that locked in the use of red at Christmas in America was the poinsettia. This Mexican plant looked to be just another green leafy growth that blended in with a large array of other native plants. Until just before Christmas, when a host of the poinsettia's leaves broke out in a shockingly brilliant scarlet. But it was probably a bishop's robes that really entrenched red as the second most important color of the holiday season. By the Middle Ages, the legend of St. Nicholas, the cleric from the Dark Ages, who often gave gifts to children in his church district, had become a very important part of December throughout Eastern Europe. In stories and paintings, Nicholas was almost always dressed in red robes, which would prompt those who invented Santa Claus in the early 1800s to outfit the jolly old elf in red as well. With this final addition, a scarlet hue had been permanently affixed to the holiday season in every corner of the world. The third color, always seen during the holidays, probably has the clearest association to the Christian faith. One of the gifts the wise men brought to the baby Jesus was gold. So this valuable and shiny metal was linked to Christmas before almost anything else could be. Gold was also the color associated with wealth and royalty. Certainly the Son of God was worthy of a tribute in gold. It seems appropriate that the man who would someday be mocked as King of the Jews would be associated with the color of the crowns that grace royal heads of state. Yet, in the case of Christmas, gold also came to signify light. A bright star, shining down on the earth, guided the wise men with its golden beam. This light would come to represent the illumination that Christ brought to the world with his teachings and by his example. And as gold was the most precious gift on earth, it fit well with Christ's mission. After all, through the gift of his own life, Christ would give humankind a way to experience eternal life in a place where the very streets are said to be paved with gold. Green, red, and gold are the three colors that announce the return of the Christmas season each year. Yet they are more than rich colors. They represent the rich history of the most celebrated holiday on earth, with green representing life that remains vital and beautiful even during the darkest trials. Red, symbolizing the blood that was shed so human souls could be reconciled to God. And gold, promising the gift of eternal life. These colors ring true at Christmas time and throughout the year. If you look hard enough, the spirit of Christ and Christmas can always be seen in the colors that make up the annual holiday rainbow. In our first story, let's listen to the story of the candy cane, originally known as stick candy, and in some parts of Europe referred to as sugar sticks. The candy cane, as you will hear in our story, was first associated with St. Nicholas Day, and for this special, will symbolize the color red. Probably as many legends centered on the candy cane as in any other Christmas tradition. Many of the tales that are known today about the familiar hook-shaped peppermint stick are probably as much fable as fact. Nevertheless, in the last 75 years, the symbolism of the candy cane, born of legend and now brought to life by a unique striping design, has made it one of the best teaching tools of the holiday season. Hard candy had been around almost as long as people have been yearning for sweets. For over 1,000 years, hard candy has been used to reward children who were good. Yet, the multicolored candy that is seen on store shelves today did not exist until 100 years ago. Because of the time it took to add additional colors by hand, in the past, hard candy was usually made in a solid color. When children began to receive special treats on St. Nicholas Day in the 4th century, hard candy was probably one of the first things enjoyed. Yet, because the ingredients for this candy were not easy to obtain, and most peasants did not have enough money to purchase these treats often, the sweet was probably a rare delicacy in most households. The rarity and the popularity of the treat means that the first Christian legend associated with the candy cane is probably based on actual events. Church history records that in 1670, the choir master at Germany's Cologne Cathedral was faced with a problem that still challenges parents, teachers, and choir directors today. In ancient Cologne, as well as in thousands of churches today, the children in the choir often grew restless and noisy during long services. Most authority figures of the time would have handled this situation through punishment, usually with a switch. Yet the choir master, who had seen this tactic used time and time again, knew that the punitive practice only worked for short periods of time. Soon, the painful lesson had been forgotten, and the children were again fidgeting and whispering to one another. The choir master came up with a sweetly brilliant plan. He sought out a local candy maker, and after looking over the treats in his shop, the music leader paused in front of some sweet white sticks. He knew that children liked this treat, and better yet, it took them a long time to consume the sticks. So this candy seemed perfect for what he needed, a way to keep the children quiet when they were not singing. Yet the choir master wondered if the priests and parents would allow him to give the children in his choir candy to eat during a church service. The congregation and clergy would get upset if the children were not quiet, but they would probably also be offended if the kids were eating candy in the sanctuary. Then inspiration struck. The choir master asked the candy maker if he could bend the sticks and make a crook at the top of each one. When the confectioner assured the director that he could, a plan was hatched. The candy would not just be a treat, it would be a teaching tool. The choir master decided that the candy's pure white color would represent the sinless life of Christ. The crook would serve as a way for the children to remember the story of the shepherds who came to visit the baby Jesus. The shepherds carried staffs or canes, and with the hook at the top of the stick, the candy now looked like a cane. Right before the service, the music leader gathered the flock around him and told them the symbolic story of the white candy stick. The congregation and the priests were enamored with the choir master's inventive tale and believed the use of biblical truths in the lesson to be indeed inspired. But the ultimate compliment for the choir master came when his choir was so busy enjoying their long-lasting treats that they didn't disturb the Christmas Eve service at all. Thus began the simple candy canes association with the Christian faith. Within 100 years, white candy canes were being placed on Christmas trees in Germany. Some may have known the story the choirmaster told his charges in Cologne, but more likely, most of those who hung these treats on the tree did so because the hook made it easy to use. The bottom line was that children could not wait for the time to take the tree down, usually on January 6th, the day of Epiphany, so that they could finally eat the decorations. Another persistent legend surrounding the candy cane is tied to Oliver Cromwell's rule in England. a time when Christmas celebrations were banned by the Puritan leader. It is said that during this short historical period, a dedicated Christian confectioner created a candy cane as a way for Christians to recognize each other on the street. The candy was supposed to be a type of code or signal, like a secret handshake. These canes, decorated with three tiny red stripes, which represented the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and another bold, thick red stripe that demonstrated the redemptive power of Christ's blood, were given out to those who professed Christ as their Savior. Could this legend be true? Possibly, but as the striping would have had to be accomplished by hand and would have taken a long time, it is doubtful that the candy maker could have distributed very many of the canes. Thus, the symbolic practice would have been observed in only a small part of England, possibly one community or village. Also, though Christmas was officially banned, corporate worship was not, so the need for a symbol of this type would have seemed unnecessary. More than likely, if this legend of the candy maker is true, it probably happened not during Cromwell's reign, but when all religions but the Church of England were officially banned. The candy maker may have been a member of an outlawed Protestant faith or the Catholic Church and used the cane as a teaching tool. So, though largely unsubstantiated, there probably is some truth in this story, and the legend survives to this day. Europeans must have brought the candy cane with them to the United States before the Revolution of 1776. But the treat's identification with Christmas didn't take root until Americans began to celebrate Christmas with presents, trees, and family gatherings 2 decades before the Civil War. It is said that a German-Swedish immigrant, August Imgard, was the first in the United States to use candy canes as ornaments. In 1847, he placed them on the fir tree he had brought into his Wooster, Ohio home for a holiday decoration. The idea quickly caught on. There are many American Christmas illustrations from the second half of the 19th century that show the candy cane as part of holiday festivities, but in each case, the candy is solid white. By the turn of the century, the candy cane was incredibly popular throughout the year, but it didn't take on its current look until the 1920s. Bob McCormick, who ran a small confectionery in Albany, Georgia, found a way to hand-twist colors into the candy canes. Soon the process was being used by others. An Indiana candy maker, whose brother was a priest, knew the old story of the red and white candy cane being used as a way to identify Christians in England. A Christian, the Indiana candy maker created canes that reflected this legend, as well as his own belief. Each of this man's festive sticks was made with the symbolism of the Trinity and of the redeeming blood, the hook for the shepherd's staff and the white for the purity of Christ. It even said that in this case, the hook was really the upside-down letter J, standing for Jesus. So while the spiritual meaning of the original colored candy cane might well have been a legend in England, within the past century, the legendary symbolism has become a reality in the United States and throughout much of the world. There can be little doubt that hard candy has been associated with the holiday season as long as children have looked forward to seeing St. Nicholas. Yet the candy cane that probably first appeared at a church service in the Middle Ages, used then as a tool to both teach and appease children, has become one of the sweetest reminders of the real reason for the Christmas season and one of the few holiday traditions that portrays the meaning of why Jesus was born. From the color red, let's move to green as another color of Christmas. For green, let's hear about the history of holly. A holly's pointed leaves symbolize the crown of thorns placed on Jesus' head before he died on the cross. Holly is known as Christdorn in German, meaning Christ thorn. Both of these symbols are meant to serve as a reminder to Christians of Jesus' suffering, but they aren't the only stories tying holly to Jesus and to the Christmas season. Holly can be found in almost all of the decorating schemes used during the Christmas holidays. Associated with Christmas for almost 1,700 years, holly was also an important facet of December life hundreds of years before Christ was born. This shiny plant has a unique power for many believers, not magical power, but symbolic power. Though early Christians were familiar with the use of holly, thanks to the Romans' use of it during winter solstice festivals, holly's initial significance probably began with the Celts. Many people who maintained a close tie with nature considered the plant one of the two most important plants in the woods. Holly's earliest significance was established by one of history's most mysterious groups, the Druids. Today, the Druids are primarily remembered as being wizards, but they were much more. In the ancient Celtic society of England, they were the judges, educators, historians, doctors, astronomers, and astrologers. Roman history shows they were filling these roles as early as 200 years before Christ. In fact, the Druids probably had been plying these trades for centuries before that. Trees and plants were very important in Celtic mythology. The Druids believed a constant war was going on between the Oak King and the Holly King. These twins both wanted to control the forest. Holly always won in the winter, as the oaks lost their leaves and stood bare before the evergreen plant. In this season, holly caught everyone's attention. Because of the magical power of the holly to survive and prosper in even the darkest and cruelest winter, Druids instructed the Celts that this plant was the most powerful plant in the woods. Thus, people picked boughs of holly and brought them into their homes. They believed the tree's magic would help protect them from the evil they believed infused the season of the night. They also thought that holly, the plant that could tame the bitter wind, had the power to bring peace and understanding. So, during disputes, angry parties would stand under holly trees to work out their differences. Roman soldiers probably brought the concept of decorating with holly back to their country when they returned from duty in Britain. The shiny plant quickly took on a life of its own in the civilized world. Because it grew in winter, it quickly became associated with the winter solstice and with one of the most important gods in Roman mythology. During December, when the Romans marked the shortest days of the year with a week-long festival honoring Saturn, holly wreaths with bright red berries were given as gifts. During this week of wild celebration and partying, holly could be seen inside and outside homes, on streets, in public buildings, and in shops. It was sold, swapped, and given as a gift. Wreaths were woven with images of Saturn hanging from the boughs or positioned in the center of the arrangement. Romans believed, much like the Celts, that holly had the power to bring good luck. Hence, the more holly you had in your home, the luckier you would be. The people of Rome also felt that the plant warded off lightning strikes. A home containing holly would better survive a storm than one that was undecorated and therefore unprotected. Holly was also thought to drive away the evil powers of black magic. During this superstitious era, any plant that would keep witches at bay was considered invaluable. Savvy merchants, sensing an opportunity to enhance profits, continued to expand the uses of the plant. The sellers of the holly even convinced some that touching it would cure a host of diseases. It seemed that the more money the plant generated, the more powerful it became to the Roman people. In the first and second centuries, a time when many Romans began to convert to Christianity, the persecution of believers drove worship underground. In a society that made a sport of killing Christians, believers had to be very careful in order to remain safe. Thus, even the most devout followers of Jesus decked their homes with holly during the Saturnalia festival. Over the next 200 years, a time when Christianity would emerge as the state religion, Christian and pagan Romans alike had problems recalling the origin of certain annual customs. Holly was one of the old Roman holiday traditions adopted or absorbed by Christians. But as it became a symbol of Christian faith, its meaning changed. Christians began using holly as a teaching tool to explain the life and death of Christ. Initially, the prickly leaves represented the crown of thorns that had been placed on Jesus' head on the day of the crucifixion. The plant's red berries were to remind believers of the blood that the Savior shed on the cross for their sins. This association between the crucifixion and holly quickly spread, and as it did, legends and stories about this link abounded. Thanks to the Christian symbolism passed on by a host of early church missionaries and clerics, in Germany, holly was called Christdorn. According to a German legend, it was actually holly branches that had been woven into the painful crown that was placed on Christ's head while the soldiers mocked him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews!" The Germans also taught that holly berries had been white until the crown of thorns cut into Jesus' brow. His blood was so powerful that it not only turned the berries on the crown to crimson, but every holly berry in the entire world suddenly turned red. Another legend soon evolved about the holly tree. This legend claimed that the wood of a holly tree was used to construct the cross. It was said that none of the trees in the woods would bow to the axe of those constructing the cross. Each time a man hit a tree with a sharp blade, the tree would explode into cinder-sized fragments rather than give itself to this evil purpose. When the holly tree allowed itself to be chopped down and formed into a cross, it became known as the chosen tree and was therefore given the position of being the tree that was part of God's grand plan of redemption. As such, it became a symbol of the passion. Yet another legend associated with holly is much like a legend attributed to another Christmas plant, the poinsettia. In this story, an orphan boy who had been adopted by the shepherds was in the field with them when the angels appeared to announce the birth of Jesus. The child traveled with the men to see the babe in the manger. When he arrived, he was not only deeply moved, but also embarrassed. He had no gift to present to the baby. The poor little boy resorted to the only skill he really knew and wove a crown for this newborn king. He chose limbs from a holly tree as the material for the project. When he laid the modest gift on the baby's head, Jesus touched the crown and it began to sparkle. The orphan was so deeply affected that he cried, his tears falling on the holly. When the child's tears touched the plant's white berries, it turned them a beautiful deep scarlet. Some people believe that this legend was part of the inspiration behind the Christmas carol, Little Drummer Boy. There's no proof of this, but the legend, coupled with the already existing use of holly by the Romans in December, probably did pave the way for holly's being more closely associated with Christ's birth than his death. A final story that fully illustrates the plant's firm link to Christian history and tradition is found not in the history and lore of the green plant itself, but in its name. Because of holly's association with the crucifixion, some scholars believe that the word holy was extracted from the word holly. There is nothing to definitively link the two words, but if this is true, the plant is likely behind the word holiday and is therefore tied to Christmas in another unique fashion. A host of songs and poems have been written about the plant, so steeped in ancient lore. The fact that it has its roots in pagan rituals should not deter Christians from using holly as one of the Christmas season's most profound symbols. While a majority of Christmas traditions deal strictly with the birth of Christ or with secular legends, holly stands apart, reminding us what the Christ child was sent here to do. Thus, once thought powerful enough because it could survive the toughest winter, holly has become a symbol of the strength that is available to all who call upon the name of the Lord. You are listening to the 2023 Sight and Sound Christmas Special, the the colors of Christmas. In this year's special, we are focusing on red, green, gold, and white as the colors of Christmas. I'm Terry Dorado. Let's continue with the colors of Christmas with the color of gold. Gold. Glimmering gold is associated with Christmas because, as the story goes, the three wise men brought gold, frankincense, and myrrh to the Christ child. The color gold is considered to represent royalty and wealth. In ancient times, poor people who could not afford gold-colored decorations substituted it with yellow. There is also the gold color of bells. In our story, let's listen to the story of one of the most popular Christmas songs of all time. John Pierpont died a failure. In 1866, at age 81, he came to the end of his days as a government clerk in Washington, D.C., with a long string of personal defeats abrading his spirit. Things began well enough. He graduated from Yale, which his grandfather had helped found, and chose education as his profession with some enthusiasm. He was a failure at school teaching. He was too easy on his students, and so he turned to the legal world for training. He was a failure as a lawyer. He was too generous to his clients and too concerned about justice to take the cases that brought good fees. The next career he took up was that of dry goods merchant. He was a failure as a businessman. He could not charge enough for his goods to make a profit and was too liberal with credit. In the meantime, he had begun writing poetry, and though it was published, he didn't collect enough royalties to make a living. He was a failure as a poet, and so he decided to become a minister, went off to Harvard Divinity School, was ordained as minister of the Hollis Street Church in Boston. But his position for prohibition and against slavery got him crosswise with the influential members of his congregation, and he was forced to resign. He was a failure as a minister. Politics seemed a place where he could make some difference, and he was nominated as the Abolition Party candidate for governor of Massachusetts. He lost. Undaunted, he ran for Congress under the banner of the Free Soil Party. He lost. He was a failure as a politician. The Civil War came along, and he volunteered as a chaplain of the 22nd Regiment of the Massachusetts Volunteers. 2 weeks later, he quit, having found the task too much of a strain on his health. He was 76 years old. He couldn't even make it as a chaplain. Someone found him an obscure job in the back offices of the Treasury Department in Washington, and he finished out the last 5 years of his life as a menial file clerk. He wasn't very good at that either. His heart was just not in it. John Pierpont died a failure. He had accomplished nothing he set out to do or be. There's a small memorial stone marking his grave in Mount Auburn Cemetery in Cambridge, Massachusetts. The words in the granite read, "Poet, preacher, philosopher, philanthropist." From this distance in time, one might insist that he was not, in fact, a failure. His commitments to social justice, his desire to be a loving human being, his active engagement in the great issues of his times, and his faith in the power of the human mind, these are not failures. And much of what he thought of as defeat became success. Education was reformed, legal processes were improved, credit laws were changed, and above all, slavery was abolished once and for all. Why am I telling you this? It's not an uncommon story. Many 19th century reformers had similar lives, similar failures and successes. In one very important sense, John Pierpont was not a failure. Every year, come December, we celebrate his success. We carry in our hearts and minds a lifelong memorial to him. It's a song. It's a terribly simple song about the simple joy of whizzing through the cold, white dark of winter's gloom in a sleigh pulled by one horse and with a company of friends laughing and singing all the way. No more, no less. Jingle Bells. John Pierpont wrote Jingle Bells. To write a song that stands for the simplest joys, to write a song that 300 or 400 million people around the world know, a song about something they've never done but can imagine, a song that every one of us, large and small, can hoot out the moment the chord is struck on the piano and the chord is struck in our spirit. Well, that's not failure. One snowy afternoon in deep winter, John Pierpoint penned the lines as a small gift for his family and friends and congregation. And in doing so, left behind a permanent gift for Christmas, the best kind, not the one under the tree, but the invisible, invincible one of joy. In our final story, let's hear about the story of white as one of the colors of Christmas. White has long been associated with peace and innocence in many cultures and religious traditions. Mary, the Virgin Mother of Jesus, is often portrayed as wearing white garments in art, lending the color a strong association with purity. Let's not forget that a landscape of pure white snow has become the standard that most people dream of on Christmas morning. This association of snow with Christmas may have begun with the 1822 poem, A Visit from St. Nicholas, now known as 'Twas the Night Before Christmas, which mentions a blanket of snow on Christmas Eve as Santa arrived. And of course, there's the popular holiday song White Christmas, penned by composer Irving Berlin and first sung by Bing Crosby in December 1941. This Christmas song would become one of the greatest selling singles of all time. In this story, titled The White Kid Gloves, we will hear how material possessions can never overpower love and the true meaning of Christmas. The dictionary defines happiness as good luck, prosperity, and a state of well-being. But whenever I read this accepted definition, I always remember that the one moment of utter happiness I cherish out of a lifetime was attended by none of these things. In fact, it was just the opposite. Luck had been so long absent from us as to become a total stranger. Prosperity was not even around the most distant corner, and I was running a low fever. The winter that I was 16, my father suffered a series of crippling business reverses, owing to circumstances he could not control. He was the owner of a small company which he had founded and built, and he loved it with the devotion of a man who understands and appreciates hard work. It was in the middle of October that he was forced to pay out of his working capital the sum of $25,000. Not his debt, understand, but as default on a loan he had co-signed for a friend. After this tremendous cash outlay, we were literally penniless, with eventual recovery lying months or years in the future, if at all. The times were inflationary, and almost the bitterest pill to swallow was the fact that prosperity flourished on all sides. Father had established a standard of living that corresponded to his prospect, a pleasant home with a sizable mortgage, a wife he loved to indulge, and two expensive and slightly spoiled children, Stanley and me. My father was not a man to burden his family with business worries, and during the early days of his trouble, he brooded in silence the downward path of his fortunes. As the number of his employees diminished, then vanished altogether, and his working hours increased, he was forced to take my mother into his confidence. I do not know to what extent she was frightened by his disclosure, for she never gave an outward sign. She did dispense with her maid and the yard man, taking upon herself the full role of cook and housekeeper, with my brother and me as her assistants. Needless to say, we were not filled with enthusiasm. While I fretted at the ironing board, and Stanley grumbled as he stoked the furnace and raked the autumn leaves, my mother sang at her work. and my father summoned a kind of haunted cheer in our presence. It was only after we had been sent upstairs to attack our homework that the burden of unease seeped through the house. I would lean over the banister in the dark and pick up bits of conversation which drifted from below. "But Whit, you could sell the business."
"I don't know. I suppose so, at a loss."
"It would relieve you of a burden. You could always get a job."
"That might solve things. Gebhardt could take me on."
"But you don't really want to sell it, do you?"
"No, I believe in it. If we can weather this spell..."
"I believe in it, too, and we'll find a way. No, you're not to worry."
The power of money over human beings is a devastating thing. It's not edible, is of no use in building a fire. In any elemental situation, it is worse than useless. But in the limits of our society, too much can be a dagger and too little a bludgeon.
I don't suppose that father and mother ever thought we would actually go hungry or cold, but they know that the quarterly note on the house mortgage would roll around inevitably, along with the insurance premiums and the taxes and the fuel bills and the grocery accounts. They knew, too, that credit and honor are inseparable.
"I don't know how to tell you this," I overheard my father speak. "I've taken a job."
"You decided to give up the business." Mother's voice was sad with defeat.
"No, I'm on as night clerk at the El Dorado Hotel."
"But Whit, you can't work night and day."
"You underestimate me. Now don't blubber, Eloise. You know I can't stand a crying woman."
I scuttled up from the landing as they began to come toward the stairs. My cheeks were hot with shame. My father... working in a cheap hotel. I didn't know anybody whose father was a night clerk. It was mean and horrid. I couldn't admit it to myself, much less to my friends.
If life had been uneasy before, after my father began his double duty, it became doubly so. He would stumble home at 6 a.m., fall into bed until noon, then eat lunch and set out for his empty office. He did not come home again at dinner time, and my brother and I rarely saw him, except on Saturday and Sunday mornings when we were not in school. He looked very tired and cross, and we missed his joking and teasing. We missed him. But my mother was as someone who was bereaved. Oh, she kept up a program of the stiff upper lip when we were in earshot, and most of the time was too busy to mope. But during the long winter evenings, I can remember her attacking the darning as if each raveled sock were a bitter enemy.
Christmas had always been a glorious time for us. From my earliest childhood, I could remember the rows of cakes, the fresh coconut, the plummy dark fruit cakes and chocolate layer cake, mince and apple pies, the homemade fudge and divinity candy. The house was always alive with the delicious smells, turkey baking and spices and the scent of the Christmas tree. The doorbell never stopped ringing, but somehow the doorbell gets less busy in troubled times. And this year, nobody mentioned Christmas. Stanley and I waited in vain for some cheering word.
"I want a bike," Stan confided.
"Ed Miller has one. Jerry's going to get one. I just got to have a bike."
"I don't think we can afford it. I think we're poor."
"Are we? Who told you?"
"Nobody. I just think so."
"We still go to the movies."
"Yes, but they don't. They don't want us to be deprived."
"What's that?"
"Well, not to have things."
"Well, then they must want me to have a bike. If I had one, I could get a paper route. Then I could make money."
"I want something pretty. Something not practical at all."
"Like what?"
"Like a party dress with a long skirt and a pair of white kid gloves."
"Oh, you're not going to any party."
"I am, too. I'm going to Ruthie's Christmas dance, but I won't go in a short dress without gloves."
Stan and I had long, solemn conferences about how we could shake the gloom from our household.
I thought of marrying a rich older man and paying off the mortgage. Stan thought he would win an air race and bring home a bag of gold and present it to Father. We had one enthusiastic notion, selling our school books to the secondhand store. The idea seemed to have everything, except we would certainly be found out. Time flew into December, the busy merchandising season, complete with emerald and scarlet trappings, department store chimes, bedraggled wreaths, and pseudo-Santa Clauses broke over us, and still no one said anything. We began to feel betrayed. The bicycle and the white kid gloves ceased to be just wishes and became clauses with us. We whined aloud and complained at our housework. "Maybe it isn't coming this year." "What isn't coming?" my mother asked me. "Christmas." "Christmas always comes for people who have the right spirit."
"Not to us."
"Christmas comes in your heart. But not like last year. Nothing is the same anymore. Nothing." You probably won't believe me now, but you'll find out someday that the real joy of life is giving, not getting. "But that's just it. I want to give, but I haven't any money to buy anything with." "Darling, I haven't either. You're almost a grown girl now. You'll have to find your own way. Please, don't mention this before your father." "I never see him anymore anyway."
"Well, neither do I. I'm afraid it's harder on me than it is on you. Now go wash your face."
From that day on, I was sullen and fierce, and my pride was bedraggled. But secretly, I applied for and got a job in the school cafeteria, not as a waitress, but as a dishwasher, since I could not bear the thought of moving among my schoolmates collecting their soiled trays. I did not mind the job, although it was tiresome work, but with youthful snobbery, I felt ashamed of actually needing the money. I didn't see much of Stan anymore. I got home late, and he was usually gone. The whole close-knit structure of our home seemed to have fallen apart. We were all silent and secretive, and when we were together, we did not find anything to talk about. Mother's eyes pleaded with me, but I held myself stiffly away from her. My father made wistful little jokes at Sunday breakfast, but I would frown instead of laugh. It did not occur to me that night clerking was just as hard for him as dishwashing was for me. Only Stan was normal. "I'm making him a pipe rack in manual training." "But he doesn't smoke a pipe." "I guess he would if he had one. I figure to get one to go with it."
"How?"
"I'm going to trade my knife. I know a guy who's got a pipe that's nearly new."
"What about her?"
"I'm making her a little box. I'm carving her initials on it, so she can put her beads and stuff in it. It's a real strong box." I thought warmly of my $4 I had already earned buried in the bureau drawer among my pictures of movie stars. I had spun it 100 times and stretched it 1,000 ways until it had become a fortune. Christmas came on a Wednesday that year. On the Sunday before, Father and Stanley and I hiked out into the country to get our tree, Father's first acknowledgement of the approaching day. One of the guests at the hotel had given us permission to chop a tree from his lot. The day was miserably cold, and we spent hours searching the lot for a tree even halfway suitable. Then we traipsed home again, all the while my eyes burning and nose running. That night, we trimmed the tree, and by some miracle on Father's part, all the bulbs in the string of lights glowed brightly. As we trimmed and talked again, it seemed that our mutual differences had vanished, that we were a family again, safe from the world's alarms. The pleasant glow enabled me to forget partially the fact that my throat was getting more sore by the minute. By morning, my tonsils seemed to have closed off my windpipe, but I did not mention it. It was my last day at the cafeteria, and I had to have the other $2. I took my accumulated wealth with me, and after school went shopping. The stores were crowded, and I felt very warm and light-headed. As I began to hunt for the things I had imagined buying,
I soon discovered the inadequacy of $6. One by one, I discarded my dreams, but I could not quite give up the thirst for luxury. Instead of the warm woolen socks my father needed, I came home with a pair of fine black silk ones. Though Mother would have done with a pair of stout gloves, I chose a ruffly nightgown of some sleazy pink stuff. For Stanley, I got a bicycle bell, knowing full well that he did not have a bicycle. It seemed to me that if you could not have what your heart desires, a bit of its music would be better than nothing. As I say, I was light-headed. On Christmas Eve, I felt really dreadful. My throat ached, along with my head and all other bones in my body, and my stomach kept turning over and over. I wished for nothing so much as to lie still in bed. But this was out of the question. According to our custom, the Christmas tree celebration was always on the night of Christmas Eve. Stan and I were just finishing up the supper dishes when we heard my mother at the piano and my father's voice singing snatches of Silent Night. The year before, we had raced into the room like squirrels, but tonight we walked very sedately. Stan even stood back and let me go in first. The fire blazed, and the room was soft with candlelight. The little red and green bulbs glowed like jeweled fruit on the little tree. A snowfall of packages were piled around the base, and to one side, reflecting the firelight, stood the gleaming bicycle. Stan's mouth dropped open, and I thought, with probably my first pure unselfishness, that I would rather he got it than to have anything myself. It is impossible to say more about the scene that followed. It happens multiplied millions of times in this season, and you had best remember your own time. The happy cry that leaps from a young girl's lips when she draws from its tissue wrappings her first long party dress, even if it is fashioned from Mother's last taffeta negligee. It's an old story. And your first pair of long white kid gloves with the dear little buttons on the wrist. The beautiful, delicate white kid gloves, which mean that you are grown up. It was very late when we finally settled down from the excitement. Stan was in a stupor of pleasure, wrapped in a new sweater Mother had knitted in his school colors and killing our ears with the brassy twang of the bicycle bell. My father was already wearing his new shoes, Mother's present, and was smoking the pipe that had only been smoked a time or two and coughing as he fondled his black silk socks, his face aware that they were the best money could buy. My mother had put on her pink nightgown over her dress, and I thought it became her. She sat tracing her initials, which Stan had carved into the box top, with a sort of gentle pride. I could not keep from stroking my gifts. Stan had made me a lovely fan, the crowning glory to my frivolous treasures. Bedtime was finally agreed on, but only by permitting Stan to take his bicycle upstairs with him. He swore he could not be parted with it overnight. I then insisted that I must try on my dress and gloves and show them off. I stood before the mirror in my room, slipping the amethyst taffeta over my head, though I continued to feel dizzy. The dress was designed with what I thought a daringly low neckline, and its lively color reflected in my eyes. I swished the skirt and caught it up with my long white gloves as I swept out of the room in an exaggerated copy of my favorite movie heroine. I patted the hair at the back of my neck and practiced what I thought to be a mysterious smile. As I paused on the landing to pull on my gloves, I leaned over the banister in a last moment of childish eavesdropping. My father and mother were standing before the hearth. I saw how stooped his shoulders were and the new white frost on his dark hair. "Whitney, however did you do it? The bicycle, the gloves. I don't blame you, Ellie, for thinking I've been dipping into the till at the hotel. It looks too foolish for our busted economy. But it was luck, honey. The old Barton luck coming back at last. I won that bike on a punch board at the Rexall drugstore. I went in there the other night to get a cup of coffee, and there was one hole left on the board.
What did I have to lose but a cup of coffee?
But the gloves?
Well, I saved $5. I've been walking home from the hotel. Need a breath of air after an all-night stretch, you know. And I had luck again. There were a bunch of measly-looking gloves on a table marked clearance, and right down in one corner was this pair, just what the doctor ordered, and cheap. But my luck ran out again, Ellie. I haven't gotten anything for you. I bought you a bottle of that stuff you like, that lilac stuff, but I got tangled up in the chain of the bicycle and fell down and broke it. His despair was so comic. The picture of him, entwined in the chain of Stan's new bike, reeking with the smell of lilacs, was funny enough to tickle anybody. I wanted to giggle, and I waited for my mother's laugh. But she didn't laugh. She turned toward him, so that her full face was also toward me. An indescribable radiance burned in her eyes. "I love you," she said. "I'd rather be married to you than any other man alive." It was then that my moment of happiness broke over me in brilliant, glowing splendor. It was as if angel voices sang in my ears, and my heart was open to all the secrets of life, for all life to come. In this eternity, which really lasted only a second in time, I had continued to tug at my other glove without knowing it. Now I drew it off and looked at it and pulled at the fingers to smooth them. Then I turned and went back upstairs. On Christmas morning, I had a high fever, and over my face, a rash appeared. The doctor sniffed at the door, and almost before he looked at me, made the diagnosis. "Measles. Fine thing for a great strapping girl like you, and a fine time to have the measles." But nothing could touch me. I could not even regret too deeply the loss of Ruthie's Christmas party. I was quite happy to lie in the dark and ponder my thoughts, for there was a compensation in the measles. If I had had to go to the Christmas party, my father would have discovered what he will never know. Both of the white kid gloves he had struggled so hard to buy for me were for the left hand. We hope you enjoyed the 2023 Sight and Sound Christmas Special, The Colors of Christmas. We focused on the colors of red, green, gold, and white. There are obviously even more colors associated with the Christmas season, but we decided to focus on the festive colors of red and green, the royal color of gold, and the purity of spirit with white. The 2023 Sight and Sound Christmas Special, The Colors of Christmas, was produced by Jim Martinez and read and recorded at Sight and Sound Radio, Houston, Texas. And on behalf of the staff and volunteers at Sight and Sound, we would like to wish you all a very Merry Christmas. I'm Terry Dorado.